Support for STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, comes from Ortho McNeil Neurologics Incorporated, exploring the neurological needs of patients and caregivers today, tomorrow, and in the future.
Welcome to STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, with the latest advancements in neurology and medicine. In this half hour, we'll explore infection and its challenges to neurology professionals, with a focus on influenza and other viral illnesses. We'll hear reports on today's flu vaccine. It may be a potent weapon against tomorrow's bird flu.
This could also prevent a possible genetic intermingling of H5N1's RNA with that of H1 or H3 human strains.
Poliovirus, why did it reemerge in Minnesota?
Maybe the complete eradication of any disease is yet another phrase we can't use in medicine, Marty.
We'll talk with the researcher who feels that TPA can help elderly stroke victims.
The older group had a slightly lower percent of symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage.
And reefer madness indeed. Might marijuana smoking by your adolescent be damaging fiber pathways in his brain? This is STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, the independent news source for neurology professionals. I'm Marty Goldenson. As you listen to this podcast at home, in the office, or on the road, remember you can get the complete stories in Clinical Neurology News at clinicalneurologynews.com. You can also find all of our STAT Neurology podcasts online for free at medicalnewspodcast.com. The emergence of infectious diseases is already a major issue for the 21st century. Add to that biological warfare and terrorism, resistant bugs, and their potential dissemination through worldwide jet travel, and humankind has its challenges. Today, we'll look at these issues and some of the solutions that medical science can offer. For our lead story, pick up a newspaper or look at TV these days, and you'll find headlines about avian flu. Are we on the edge of a global epidemic? Dr. Campbell Douglas fills us in.
Marty, it's a real threat. Of course, it's all over the world media, and some are saying an influenza pandemic, particularly from the H5N1 strain, is a probability, and forces have mobilized for the event. As Sharon Worcester reported in Clinical Neurology News this past November, there have been over 100 cases in Asia already.
Since this is an avian flu, is bird control a reasonable solution?
Birds are the primary vectors at this point, so control is wise. In fact, European Union recently banned poultry products and live birds coming in from Romania and Turkey after H5N1 virus was isolated there. What's scary is H5N1's ability to mutate and become transmissible between members of the same species of animals. Not just from birds to humans, but potentially from humans to humans. Mutation amplifies pandemic potential.
Are there cases of mutation with the virus passing from human to human?
It's been documented in one case so far. These were two people in Vietnam living under the same roof. The World Health Organization is saying this avian H5N1 strain does seem to have the potential for developing efficient person-to-person transmission. On the flip side, we're hearing some sources say if H5N1 were going to mutate and efficiently transmit between people, it would have done so by now.
How virulent can this bird flu get?
Cases in Asia had mortality over 50%. As you'd expect, children, chronically ill people, and elderly were affected more severely. Remember, mutation is the crux, the bridge, between the current situation and a pandemic. Fortunately, there appears to be only that one documented case of mutation and human-to-human transmission. But World Health Organization scientists are saying H5N1 could circle the globe within weeks or months and kill as many as 150 million people.
It's my understanding that we haven't had a global outbreak of flu for years. Isn't it unlikely that we would have one now?
A year of outbreaks typically comes once every 30 years. Now, at 37 years since the last one, we're overdue. Something amazing from medical microbiology adds to our sense of urgency. Last year, the journal Science published a report on the coding sequence of the actual virus responsible for the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. They could tell from that virus that it too, like H5N1, was a bird flu that infected humans. An estimated 50 million people were killed in that pandemic, more than all the casualties from World War I. No wonder this issue is high priority for government and the media.
So what's being done? Are we prepared to manage enormous numbers of cases of this H5N1 flu?
The administration's pandemic preparedness plan anticipates widespread disease from the virus, but says we're alarmingly unprepared. President Bush met with vaccine makers to urge production of more flu vaccines, and Congress might authorize billions to stockpile antiviral drugs like oseltamivir, sold as Tamiflu, in hopes of reducing the severity of the next pandemic. But there are questions about both production of adequate amounts of Tamiflu and its actual effectiveness. So are we prepared? It doesn't look like it.
What should neurology professionals do? Watch and wait for now?
The most effective thing may be to recommend currently available flu shots to their patients, even though obviously their antigenicity would cover strains different from H5N1. But the World Health Organization is now suggesting that these inoculations may help alter the progression of a dangerous outbreak.
Thanks, Dr. Campbell Douglas. We'll have more on the use of conventional flu shots to help against H5N1 just ahead. Stay connected to STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, for the latest updates on the avian flu threat. I'm Marty Goldenson.
Support for STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, comes from Ortho McNeil Neurologics Incorporated, exploring the neurological needs of patients and caregivers today, tomorrow, and in the future.
Vaccinations based on the H5N1 influenza strain are not available now. Yet the World Health Organization is urging people to get conventional flu shots as a protective measure against a possible outbreak of the avian flu. How will it help if the vaccine is based on a different strain? Nurse practitioner Heather Wise is here to explain.
Happy to, Marty. WHO's recommendations are based on two theories. First, it is possible that immunization with the available flu vaccines could reduce co-infection of H5N1 avian flu with current influenza strains, preventing a synergistic increase in morbidity and mortality. And second, this could also prevent a possible genetic intermingling of H5N1's RNA with that of H1 or H3 human strains.
Which might lead to the mutation described in our last report?
Exactly. Which increases the risk of human-to-human transmission of the avian virus.
If and when this pandemic finally comes, how would a patient know what strain they have?
That's one of the real problems. Patients with typical flu symptoms are impossible to distinguish from bird flu symptoms. We won't be able to know if it's the H5N1, H1, or H3 strain. That's what's particularly unsettling.
This outbreak is going to happen, do you think?
It's a lot about prognostication. Play with probabilities around that 30-year cycle, and chances are, within the next several years, our jet-setting global community of human beings will experience an avian flu pandemic caused by the mutated R5N1 influenza virus. Healthcare professionals must stay informed because so much is unknown. Worldwide communications will be key.
Worldwide communication, TV, radio, the internet, should help. And now, the new medium of podcasting. Thank you, nurse practitioner Heather Wise. Next, we'll answer one more question about flu shots. Who must get one this year and every year? Flu, the frightful foe. It weakens lungs for potentially lethal pneumonia to blossom. It can even lead to respiratory failure. There's a group of patients that are especially susceptible to that, children with neurological and neuromuscular disorders. Dr. Ralph Zwolinski, why are kids so vulnerable?
Marty, these children are already at high risk for respiratory failure. Research was recently conducted by pediatrician Ron Karen and his associates at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia of 750 children hospitalized for severe flu infections. Those with neurological and neuromuscular disorders showed 6 times the respiratory failure rate of otherwise normal kids who are hospitalized with the flu. The gist of Dr. Karen's research for neurology professionals is, for your patients with conditions like cerebral palsy, seizure disorders, hydrocephalus, and cerebral spinal fluid shunt, be aggressive with vaccination at the beginning of flu season.
Thanks, Dr. Zielinski. These findings were originally published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Next up, an interview with a doctor making science and the news. You're listening to STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News. I'm Marty Goldenson. It's widely believed that treating elderly stroke victims with TPA, tissue plasminogen activator, might cause bleeding in the brain. But neurologist Bart DeMarshall of the Mayo Clinic challenged that assumption and is working to better understand this clot-buster drug. Dr. Campbell Douglas spoke to Dr. DeMarshall about his research.
Thanks, Marty, and hello, Dr. DeMarshall.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for taking time from your busy schedule to discuss your research on using TPA in older stroke patients.
Well, I appreciate an opportunity to present our findings. The study that you're referring to is titled Outcomes in Octogenarians and Nonagenarians Thrombolyzed for Acute Ischemic Stroke, and myself and several of my stroke neurology colleagues in the Department of Neurology, Division of Cerebrovascular Diseases at Mayo Clinic, Arizona, conducted this piece of research and presented it as an abstract at the American Academy of Neurology meeting in September of 2005 in San Diego. We have collectively felt that there is a perceived risk of intracerebral hemorrhage in the very elderly population that receive thrombolysis for acute ischemic stroke. And as we all know, the elderly really comprise the fastest growing segment of our society. And in most stroke centers like ours, the 80 and 90 year old population may actually comprise about a third of the acute ischemic stroke population. So it's a large group. And there has been this notion that one should withhold thrombolysis. Age alone has never served as a strict exclusion criteria for the provision of TPA for acute ischemic stroke, but in some stroke centers, in the exclusion criteria, it's certainly listed there as a caution or something that one should reflect upon before proceeding. Our own experience has been that there's a general tendency to withhold thrombolysis in the very elderly, and it's mostly because of this perceived heightened risk of intracerebral hemorrhage and systemic hemorrhages associated with TPA use in that population. What we did in the study was we looked at our own acute stroke registry and thrombolysis registry at the Mayo Clinic Hospital in Phoenix, Arizona.
And so what did you discover?
We found, to our surprise, that the risk of intracerebral hemorrhage post-TPA in the elderly group was not statistically significantly higher than in the younger cohort. So we divided the cohort into 2 groups, those that are less than 80 years of age that we called the young group and those that were 80 and older, which we called the old group. And there were 70 patients that were analyzed that had reached the 90-day follow-up. 48 of those patients were young and 21 were old, and of the elderly group, 18 were octogenarians and 3 were nonagenarians. What was clear is that the old patients had really, they had sustained more severe strokes. Their mean NIH stroke scale score was 16 compared to the young group, which was 14, and a higher proportion of the elderly patients had pre-existing disability before the stroke event.
Of course, bleeding into the brain and elsewhere are primary concerns. What were your findings?
What we noted was that overall, between the young and the old group, our symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage rate at 36 hours post-thrombolysis was 7%. In the young group, it was 9%, and in the old group, it was 4%. There's no statistically significant difference between those two populations. So, in fact, if anything, the older group had a slightly lower percent of symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage. Fatal intracranial hemorrhage was 2% of the population. Asymptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, 15% of the elderly group compared to 7% of the young group. And then petechial bleeding in the brain in the infarcted territory was quite common in the elderly group, 27% compared to only 2% in the young group, but that was not clinically apparent. And then when we looked at just all systemic hemorrhages, again, on the whole, it was about 10%, and it did not differ between the young and the old cohort.
So what's the bottom line regarding bleeding in the older and younger stroke populations?
Apart from some petechial bleeding into the infarct, which was not clinically significant, there were no other significant differences between the two populations.
And what about the sort of functional outcomes in the two groups?
To our amazement, the elderly group and the young group both had about the same proportion of patients that had attained a 4-point or greater NIH stroke skill score improvement at 24 hours post-TPA. So about half of the young people and half of the old people showed an improvement at 24 hours post-TPA, and that number, of course, so was the same. There was no statistically significant difference. That's where the similarities end, because if you follow these folks long-term to at least 3 months, you see that perhaps as expected, the elderly group does not fare as well. For instance, only 19% of the elderly group were at home at 90 days compared to 70% of the young group. 45% of the elderly group were alive at 90 days compared to 72% of the young group. But the point was that the elderly patients, they were not succumbing to the adverse effects or risks of the thrombolysis. They seemed to demonstrate an early improvement similar to the younger cohort, and they were not faring well long-term because of complications related to the stroke and their recognized greater comorbidities compared to the younger population.
What's the take to the hospital lesson for listening doctors?
I think our message from this study is that as best we can tell from our study and at least three other stroke centers and publications that have looked at their own experience as well, all seem to suggest consistently that the elderly population appears to have approximately the same ability to improve from thrombolysis and do not appear to have a greater risk of cerebral or systemic hemorrhagic complications for TPA.
Okay, so don't withhold thrombolysis from elderly patients by virtue of their chronological age.
What would still be reasonable to consider before thrombolyzing patients is their underlying disability. And the very elderly patient that is already disabled and perhaps in a nursing home and stands very little to gain, in that cohort, there may still be a reason to refrain from thrombolysis, because it's not realistic that there will be great gains made. But in terms of chronological age alone, it shouldn't serve as an exclusion criteria.
No blanket statements for this art and science we call the practice of medicine.
Yes, I agree.
The research adds some comfort for doctors making difficult decisions in the acute stroke setting. I want to remind STAT listeners to find the summary of Dr. DeMarshall's results in Betsy Bates' article in December's Clinical Neurology News. And now back to you, Marty.
The Mayo Clinic's Dr. Bart DeMarshall, talking with STAT's Dr. Campbell Douglas. Thanks, Dr. DeMarshall. Thanks, Dr. Douglas. You can read Betsy Bates' article on the DeMarshall study in the December 2005 issue of Clinical Neurology News. STAT podcasts are created exclusively to serve neurology healthcare professionals. We welcome your comments at feedback@medicalnewspodcast.com. Next week, a show on new hope for improved cost-benefit ratios for patients and the profession. This is STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, the independent news source for neurology professionals. I'm Marty Goldenson.
Support for STAT, the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, comes from Ortho McNeil Neurologics Incorporated, exploring the neurological needs of patients and caregivers today, tomorrow, and in the future.
Now for our weekly briefing, a roundup of neurology news about infection and its challenges to neurology professionals. The recent incidence of avian flu may remind us of another illness that jumped continents in recent years, West Nile virus. Here's a question for you. What animals other than mosquitoes contribute to the spread of West Nile virus? Not to give them a totally bad rap, but even without avian flu, birds carry a slew of disease contagions. There's psittacosis, cryptococcosis, Sercarial dermatitis, and Q fever, and they're known to be part of the transmission cycle of West Nile virus. Nurse practitioner Heather Wise is here with the latest on the many wings of the West Nile disease.
Marty, it's known that over 200 species of birds are susceptible to infection from mosquito bites. And while the birds do not spread the West Nile virus to humans, mosquitoes which bite an affected bird do. In just the past 2 years, there were roughly 1,500 cases of West Nile virus reported in the U.S. But as a result of Hurricane Katrina and the other devastating storms, there may be significantly fewer cases this year. Hurricane winds are pretty good at eliminating birds, and in fact, the bird populations in the storm areas have been decimated. So, the risk of contracting West Nile virus may actually be down.
So, DEET-free living, thanks to fewer birds?
Don't ditch the DEET yet. There is still a great deal of standing flood water left over from the storms, and there are other mosquito-borne illnesses out there. While we aren't expecting a big outbreak of West Nile virus, mosquitoes are on the increase. With people displaced by the storms and housing so severely damaged, people are exposed to the elements more than ever. Aerial spraying is being conducted, but people in the region are still encouraged to take measures to protect themselves. So using effective repellents, repairing window screens, and wearing mosquito netting are advised.
More rain, more mosquitoes, high winds, fewer birds. It seems like everything is connected, so no increase in West Nile virus. I wish we could say the same thing for bird flu. Thank you, Heather Wise, nurse practitioner. Read more about this in Michelle Sullivan's article in Clinical Neurology News at www.clinicalneurologynews.com. Our last brief is about a disease everyone thinks has been wiped out. In 1952, at the height of the polio epidemic, nearly 60,000 cases were reported in the United States alone. 3,000 people died and many more were paralyzed. Widespread vaccination eliminated the disease from the Western Hemisphere by 1991. Polio still lingers on in Africa and other parts of the developing world, but most people think of polio as a disease that's been conquered. Then, last September, in 2005, 5 children in rural Minnesota were diagnosed with that illness. Here to report is Dr. Ralph Zwolinski. I thought polio had been eradicated.
Most of us thought so too, but maybe the complete eradication of any disease is yet another phrase we can't use in medicine, Marty. The 5 Minnesota children reported to have poliovirus infection are members of an Amish community. The Amish often decline vaccinations. The Center for Disease Control believes that one child was exposed on a trip abroad. Not every country uses the new injectable vaccine made from inactive antigens. Apparently, this child was exposed to someone who had taken live attenuated virus from the older oral vaccine.
Remarkable. I remember the oral vaccine. Wasn't it given with sugar cubes?
That was the old way of getting vaccinated against polio. It worked. But there was always the risk that the child could become afflicted with polio since it contained the live, though attenuated, viruses. That's why we now use the injectable form of polio vaccine containing inactivated antigens, not the virus itself.
How does the CDC know that the polio these children have contracted isn't some new mutated strain of the virus?
A partial sequencing of the viral capsid identified it as a type-derived from one of those 3 Sabin oral polio vaccines.
Thanks for that briefing, Dr. Ralph Zwolinski. You can read Robert Finn's account of this case in Clinical Neurology News. Now, for the very first stat question of the week. The brain teaser for this podcast is, in what year was that oral polio vaccine widely replaced by the injectable vaccine? If you think you know the answer, email us at feedback@medicalnewspodcast.com, and please tell us how to pronounce your name. And now, just a moment for a lighter topic, malpractice. Just kidding. Dr. Campbell Douglas.
You hit a nerve, Marty. It appears deep pockets are prerequisite to practicing neurology these days. Using data from the Physicians Insurers Association of America, an analysis was recently made in Clinical Neurology News. It compares the average indemnity payment for neurologists with those for all physicians. Neurologists won't be happy to hear that the average indemnity payment has been $350,000 to $450,000 per case, well above other specialties over the last 5 years. And the trend is only going up.
Thanks, Kemp. Not welcome news, but important information. You can see Kevin Foley's analysis at clinicalneurologynews.com. And while you are there, see the Neurology Image of the Month. Coming up, this week's Rapid Fire, where we will revisit some risks neurology professionals face, perhaps before those lawyers call. It's Stat Rapid Fire. Manning the artillery this week is nurse practitioner Heather Wise.
Number one, the fertility drug clomiphene linked to spinal neural tube defects. A small study from University of California, San Francisco reported significantly increased risk of neural tube defects in babies born to mothers exposed to clomiphene. Given the study's limitations, however, the findings should not impact clinical decision-making, but should be the impetus for larger, better-defined research. Look for neurologic complications of anesthesia. Although rare, the risk of severe neurologic complications exists from spinal and epidural anesthesia in labor and delivery. Most common are spinal hematoma, cauda equina syndrome, bacterial meningitis, and epidural abscess. X-rays, gamma rays added to carcinogen list. Exposure to gamma rays and X-rays was recently added to a national list of carcinogens. Some physicians are concerned patients will misunderstand this information and refuse diagnostic imaging. Dr. Richard Morin of the American College of Radiology warns that studies showing a cancer risk from X-ray exposure use doses of radiation much higher than those any patient would ever receive from imaging studies. And finally, new options may be needed for warfarin-related intracranial hemorrhage. According to a Mayo Clinic report, reversing warfarin-induced intracerebral hemorrhage using fresh frozen plasma and vitamin K is insufficient. A study cited logistical problems and delays in obtaining FFP, causing 10 to 16-hour delay for patients needing immediate treatment. Conclusion? Findings should open the door for development of faster and more effective therapies. Back to you, Marty.
Thanks for that rapid-fire report, Nurse Practitioner Heather Wise. And last but not least, put on those X-ray glasses that you bought years ago and take a gander at the wealth of astounding research findings that came out of December's annual meeting of the Radiological Society of North America. Reefer madness indeed. In every parent's nightmare, their teenagers become irreparably damaged from the same recreational drugs they used, supposedly harmlessly, in their own misspent youth. Recent findings from diffusion tensor imaging, a really cool display of disrupted water flow in the brain that has to be seen to be appreciated, revealed disturbing news. The brains of both a small group of adolescents who had smoked marijuana daily for a year and a group of schizophrenic teens showed the same structural abnormalities in the fiber pathway that connects the Broca's area in the left frontal lobe with the Wernicke's area in the left temporal lobe. This area of the brain continues its development throughout adolescence and is a language auditory pathway. When faced with a teen who neither speaks nor seems to listen, now there is really something to worry about. We cropped Reefer Madness Indeed from author Sally Kubitin's feature Indications, which is available at Clinical Neurology News' sister publication, InternalMedicineNews.com. That's that for now. We hope you've gained valuable insights into infections, the uncertainties, and the risks on this fourth episode of STAT. Next week will be brighter as we explore hope for improved cost-benefit ratios for patients and the profession. I hope you'll join us. I'm Marty Goldenson. STAT is the podcast of Clinical Neurology News, the independent news source for neurology professionals, a co-production of Flow Productions, Murray Street, and International Medical News Group. They are solely responsible for its content. Written by Dr. William Campbell Douglas. Editors Lauren Krenzel and Steve Rath. Information Technology Calvin Simmons. STAT content is based on Clinical Neurology News, a copyrighted publication of Elsevier International Medical News Group. We invite your comments on issues in this podcast or in your practice. Please refer to STAT episode number 4 and email feedback at medicalnewspodcast.com. Please include a daytime phone number and tell us how to pronounce your name. You can download STAT at medicalnewspodcast.com or set iTunes Media Player and your iPod to download STAT automatically using the feed www.medicalnewspodcast.com/cnn.xml. That's our site, and that's our program for this week. If you invite us, we'll be back in your ears next week. with more clinical neurology news for the 21st century. For STAT, I'm Marty Goldenson. STAT Podcast is a copyrighted production of International Medical News Group and Flow Productions, copyright 2006.
Support for STAT, the podcast of clinical neurology news, comes from Ortho McNeil Neurologics Incorporated, exploring the neurological needs of patients and caregivers today, tomorrow, and in the future.